listening to One to One with Paul Costello, a podcast from the Stanford School of Medicine.
Stanford professors Justin and Erica Sonnenberg's book, The Good Gut, takes you inside the world of microbiota, the 100 trillion bacteria that make up our gut and define whether we're healthy or not. They argue in the book that because of our changes in diet, overuse of antibiotics, and the frenzy of over-sterilization, our gut microbiota is facing a mass extinction event. So if you're interested in finding out how the world of microbes and bacteria interplay with human health, diet, mood, food allergies, autism, and even cancer, stay tuned for my interview with Stanford Medicine Professor Justin Sonnenberg and The Good Gut. Thank you for joining me, Justin. The book is really intriguing. Would you call this field the microbiome field, the microbiota? Is it a new field? Is it sort of an exploding field? I've read in the past, when I've been trying to get up to speed, reading the book and reading other things, it's like there's right now, it's time, it's moment. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, in terms of discovery, I think it feels like a very new field. In terms of the history, you know, it goes back to van Leeuwenhoek in the 1700s. So we've known that there have been microbial communities in and on our body for a long time. Over 100 years ago, there were studies of how diet influences the microbes in our gut. And so we've known that this community is there, but it's really been DNA sequencing technology that over the past decade has enabled this just huge expansion in our understanding of this community and fueled all the discoveries that are biomedically focused that connect this gut microbiota to so many facets of our health.
Hey, what are we learning about how this, as you said, the vast array of microbes play in good health and disease? What are we learning about that?
Yeah, well, I think initially, actually, when a lot of us got into this field back, you know, I'd say a lot of the people that are at the forefront of this field right now have been studying the microbial communities in our gut for maybe 10, 15 years. And at that time, when we started doing this, it seemed like a quirky facet of our biology, something that was kind of interesting, unknown, a lot to explore. And I don't think any of us quite understood the huge connections that would be laid out over this past decade connecting these microbes to our health. I mean, it's very clear that they control facets of our metabolism, so they can influence things like obesity, diabetes. They connect to our immune system, and they, not just in our gut. So originally we thought that these would be microbes that help us with digestion, influence gut health, and it turns out that they control so much of our biology across all of our body. How likely you are to respond and clear a respiratory infection can be influenced by your gut microbes. In aspects of the brain-gut axis, so moods
and
behavior.
Depression.
Yeah, exactly. And so one of the exciting but still frustrating aspects of this field is that there are many tantalizing findings, many of them conducted in model organisms like laboratory mice, where we can see that gut microbes can influence behavior and can influence how, for instance, scared or hyperactive mice get. And now the next step is to translate those findings to humans and actually see, one, whether these hold up. I think they're likely to in many cases. And then two, what the details are so that we can go in and intervene in ways that improve human health.
What was your pathway into this? How did you move into this area?
Yeah, so my background actually is a field called glycobiology, and that field really is concerned with understanding carbohydrates and not necessarily the type that we eat, although that comes back to be very important for the gut microbiota, but glycobiology in the context of cell-cell interactions in our body, and all cells of our body are covered in this tremendous coating of complex carbohydrates. It's the outermost layer of our cells, and it's what pathogens, things like viruses and bacteria, recognize when they're coming to invade and attach and cause disease. And so I really got interested in the interactions of microbes and are carbohydrates and how that changes over our evolution, how we might escape a disease by changing the carbohydrate landscape of our cells. And most people think about this in terms of disease-causing bacteria. And what I found during graduate school was this new field of microbiota research where there appeared to be an opposite interaction, where the carbohydrates on our cells may actually be responsible for fostering beneficial interactions with microbes. So exactly the opposite of what pathogens are doing. And this really tightly linked to the gut microbiota and how it was interacting with us.
You write, and you argue in the book, that microbiota are facing a mass extinction event. I mean, that sounds like a cataclysmic event to the body. What does that mean? What are the implications to the human body?
Yeah, this is really the million-dollar question for the field right now. I think so. There, one of the really big efforts by the government was over the past 10 years in this field was the Human Microbiome Project. The National Institutes of Health decided to pour a lot of money into this field to lay a foundation for discovery, and it was a tremendously successful program. One of the goals of this program was to define what a healthy microbiota is. And so the way that they went about this was very logical. You take a group of healthy people and different groups of diseased people, maybe suffering from diabetes or inflammatory bowel disease or other diseases, and you simply look at what microbes are present in these different groups. And in doing that, see what defines healthy people in terms of their gut microbiota and what defines the microbiota of diseased people. And certainly in these cases, you see that in many diseases, the microbiota is different. But what became clear is that the microbiota of healthy people largely looks similar to one another. And so this really kind of formed our definition of a healthy microbiota. But then people started to study traditional populations around the world and looking at microbiotas associated with populations that actually don't develop Western diseases. So if you go to hunter-gatherer populations or rural agriculturalists, a lot of them don't have the autoimmune diseases, obesity, diabetes, cancers that we have in the Western world. And people started to sequence their microbiotas. And what we started to realize is that the Western microbiota actually looks quite different. The American microbiota, microbiota of industrialized countries, actually appears to be missing bacterial species that likely were present for much of our evolution, as we're inferring from looking at these traditional populations that don't have access to antibiotics, don't have a lot of the sanitation we have, and just have a very, very different lifestyle and diet. And so what we think has happened is over the course of our modernization, we've actually eradicated certain species in our gut microbiota. A lot of this has probably been brought on by our war on pathogenic microbes and collateral damage caused by things like antibiotic use. And in losing these beneficial microbes, we may have incited an imbalance in host microbial interactions. And there's an emerging hypothesis that this imbalance actually lies at the basis of many Western diseases.
Talk more about the three elements that you've just hit on. One is diet, the other is overuse of antibiotics, and the other is over-sterilization. So let's talk first about the over-sterilized environment. Everyone has hand wipes today. You can buy at every store possible, you know, sort of wipes to clean your counters, etc. You know, we keep kids in sort of a bubble environment in many ways. Talk more about what the implications of that are.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, so just to zoom out a little bit, I think one commonality of these things that you're mentioning that appear to have had a negative impact on the microbiota is that they appeared to be beneficial at the time of their implementation. So sanitation, antibiotics, even processed food in terms of feeding mass populations cheaply, all of these things appeared to be greatly beneficial and were all implemented in the absence of us knowing that we have these microbes inside of us that are so important to our health. So we weren't really aware, the medical community wasn't aware of the potential collateral damage that has happened. About 20 years ago or so, there was this emerging idea of the hygiene hypothesis that over-sterilization of our environment could lead to immune imbalances that drove autoimmune diseases, allergies, asthma, things like that. And this originally was thought to, or was pinned on the lack of infectious agents, that we had cleaned our environment so well that we had gotten rid of infections and our immune system was struggling in terms of knowing what to do. And so it was attacking ourselves. This made a lot of sense in a very kind of zoomed out way. As we're learning more and more about how the immune system interacts with the microbes in our environment, what we realize is that the immune system is greatly impacted by these resident microbes, especially those that live in our digestive tract. And so as we've cleaned up our environment, not only have we gotten rid of the infectious agents and thereby maybe changed how our immune system responds in some way, but we've also minimized our interaction with non-harmful environmental microbes. So microbes you might encounter in soil or that you might eat on dirty food. The benefit of this is really reducing infectious disease. So the very, very small chance that you'll get infectious disease has been reduced even further. And so that's wonderful. We have a lot less foodborne illness. But the cost of that potentially is less interaction with non-harmful environmental microbes that may be playing an important role in tuning our immune system to the proper set point.
There's also a power of having an animal, a dog.
Yeah, absolutely. Dogs, farm animals. So there have been some great studies. A lot of the studies in the field come in kind of two flavors. One is very mechanistic, where we go into laboratory mice and we recreate certain experimental conditions and try to iron out the molecular mechanisms of what happened. At the other end of the spectrum are epidemiological studies, where we actually look at huge cohorts of humans and try to make inferences about lifestyle that may impact these sorts of diseases. And so there's been some really interesting observations and data related to farm animals, for one. It appears that if you grow up in the presence of cows, for instance, you're much less likely to have allergies and asthma. It's also been shown that if you have antibiotics early in life, your risk of those diseases goes up. But if you have a dog and take antibiotics early in life, the risk goes back down. So it appears that there is something to exposure to microbes. And we certainly know that dogs are a great conduit for coming in contact with environmental microbes. There's something about that that appears to dampen our immune system reactivity to ourselves and decrease these autoimmune chances of acquiring these autoimmune diseases.
You talked about neurology and the brain and moods and disorders and depression. And what are you learning about the connection of this to mood, to brain, to neurology?
Yeah. So it's a really exciting area. And the original studies looking at this were looking at a really controlled environment, looking at mice. And one of the great things about studying laboratory mice is we can keep them in an environment that's completely sterile and where they have no microbes associated with their body. We call them germ-free or microbiota-free mice. And so in maintaining mice in that condition, you can really get the stark contrast of no microbes associated with your body versus another mouse that has all of their microbes associated with them, and then start to look at things like behavior. And so groups of researchers have done this and seen that there's huge behavioral changes if you do or do not have microbes in your gut. These studies have been extended to even look at mice that are known to be a little bit more hyperactive, neurotic acting versus mice that are calmer, and then performing microbiota transplant experiments. And this is really the gold standard in the field for understanding if the microbiota is responsible for a certain phenotype or observed behavior in a mouse. If you perform a microbiota transplant where you actually swap the microbiotas of these mice, so their mouse genes stay the same, but all of their microbial genes change, and they then, in this case, took on the personality of the donor mouse. So just by moving the microbes from one mouse to another mouse, you could change the behavior of those recipient mice. So that really is the best evidence that microbes in our gut have the capacity to change behavior. And now the field is really taking off, trying to understand the molecular mediators of this and to understand it in humans. There was probably the best data in humans is a study where they actually looked at the, they used fMRI to study brain activity, and they took a group of women, gave them either a placebo yogurt with no live microbes or a regular yogurt that contained live microbes. They fed them this, either the placebo or the real microbes for several weeks, and brought the women in and did fMRI imaging on them and showed that the brain activity of the two groups were very different and reproducibly different from one another. So that really suggests that if you're consuming microbes, that may change your microbiota and then influence the brain activity in some way.
One of the things that you're trying to do in your book, The Good Gut, is that you're trying to help people make decisions about evaluating choices. And one of the significant choices you talk about is food. So tell me more about the path that you're trying to lead people down about food choices.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, you know, that first of all, just to talk about the major motivation for writing this book, I think, you know, just being in this field, my wife is a scientist with me, and we you know, both run this lab together at Stanford studying the gut microbiota. We have two daughters. They're now 7 and 10 years old, but have really been born and grown up in our household at a time where we're just immersed in this sort of research. And we realized that we were making very different decisions. We were eating differently, feeding them differently, making different choices about, you know, things like hand washing and appropriate times to do that and exposure to microbes. We got a dog. Several things we had done based around kind of basic research in the gut microbiota and our understanding. And a lot of this was focused on diet. And I'll come back to the details of that, but we really started eating differently and realizing that none of our friends, whether they were scientists or otherwise, were doing the same things we were doing until we'd go to a microbiota meeting. And then all of the other scientists that were studying the microbiota we saw were doing a lot of the same things we were doing. And so we thought, well, this is, you know, we have a privileged access to information here, and this really isn't right. We should make this available to non-scientists or other scientists that aren't in this field so that they can understand where the data's at, that it's not we don't know everything yet, but there are a lot of implications of what we know right now. And certainly the things that we're proposing in this book and the changes that we've made to our lifestyle, I would say are things where we know that if it turns out the field is completely wrong, the costs are not very significant, and the benefits are potentially profound.
What are the chances that this is completely wrong?
I think very small. I think as time goes on, the data is getting stronger and stronger that what we suggest in this book is, and in fact, there was just a major report by several medical groups, and one of their major proposals is that people should just try to eat, and they even go further than we do, over 50 grams per day of fiber. And the reason that this is such a key component of what we're doing and what we suggest in the book, and I think where Western civilization has kind of gone wrong, is that dietary fiber is what fuels this important microbial community in our gut. It is the nutrient that drives most of the metabolism there. And the reason for that is these microbes live at the end of the digestive tract. So all of the simple nutrients, amino acids and proteins, simple sugars, fats, all of those things get absorbed in the small intestine, in the upper portion of the GI tract. And it's really these complex carbohydrates that are found in dietary fiber in all of the plants that you eat that we can't digest on our own. They make their way through our digestive tract, and that is all that's left for the microbes in our colon to survive on. And so they've become professional fiber degraders. But then if we look at what's happened to the Western diet, fiber consumption has just plummeted over the past century or so. If you go to these traditional populations, some of these hunter-gatherers eat on the order of 100 to 150 grams of dietary fiber per day. And this is how we infer what an ancestral state probably was. So we probably evolved with our microbiota over hundreds of thousands of years, maybe millions of years, eating huge amounts of dietary fiber. And suddenly, just over a span of, you know, decades or centuries, we've cut that down to just 15 grams of dietary fiber. So 150 down to 15, tenfold decrease in the nutrient that's feeding this important microbial community. And we think that this is probably one of the major causes of losing many of the species, much of the diversity, that species have actually become extinct in the Western microbiota because we're not eating dietary fiber.
So if someone says today, I want to start, I want to change my dietary habits, and I want to begin introducing much more. I may not get up to 50 grams in you know, a short period of time, but I want to move in that direction.
Sure.
And maybe what's the pattern of diet that they need to start and begin with and accelerate?
Yeah, so really I think the key is eating just a lot of plants and a lot of plants that aren't processed. So, you know, it's vegetables, fruits, nuts, a lot of whole grains, legumes. All of these things have a lot of dietary fiber. And it's important, you know, we use dietary fiber as a blanket term. You can also buy fiber. You can eat Metamucil, or there are other fibers that you can buy that are purified. These may be beneficial if you don't have a way to access a lot of plants in your diet. But it's... there's such a huge diversity of complex carbohydrates that are found in plants that we eat, and that is in huge contrast to the simplified fibers that you can buy in purified form. And so it's not clear that those purified fibers would have the same health benefits as a plant-based diet that has a lot of complex fibers and a lot of diversity in the chemical structures.
Is sugar the biggest mistake, the biggest error that we make in Western culture?
So I think it is, and I think the reason is that you end up with this sort of reciprocal effect. So there are two effects of eating a diet that's high in either sugar or simple carbohydrate starchy food like refined rice and refined flour. So if you're and those are essentially those starches are essentially similar to eating sugar, because as soon as they hit your digestive tract, we can degrade those starches into glucose, which is the monomer that makes up the starches, and basically we absorb it into our bloodstream just as if we had eaten spoonfuls of sugar. So if you're eating a lot of mashed potatoes, it's very similar to just eating spoonfuls of sugar. And if you're doing that, you're obtaining a huge amount of calories that get absorbed directly into your bloodstream in your small intestine and starving your gut microbiota. So there's this twofold difference. You get higher blood sugar and starving microbes in your gut, as opposed to eating a lot of complex plant-based fibers where you end up with lower blood sugar and fueling the microbes in your gut. So I think sugar is a huge problem here, because it just is the opposite sort of calories that we should be consuming. We should be consuming calories that feed our gut microbes, and then our microbes produce chemicals that we can absorb and are beneficial to us.
So walk us through a day in the life of your family. One of the things that was interesting is you said, we've changed the way in which we've washed our hands. You know, so from the time you wake up, what sort of breakfast do you and your family have?
Yeah, so, you know, we usually have, we sit together and we eat a nice breakfast. It's usually something like oatmeal or some sort of cooked whole grain. I'm a avid sourdough bread baker, and make that bread with wheat that I actually mill. So we get the whole wheat berry ground up. And so this morning we had toast with some smoked salmon on it and olive oil. And we have granola many mornings. We always try to have fruit that we have and incorporated into our breakfast in some way. A lot of times fermented food, so I make my own kefir too. But if I haven't made that and we don't have that on hand, we'll use yogurt that we just buy from the store.
Yogurt without sugar. Yogurt.
Exactly.
Without
so this
yogurt.
Is just plain yogurt, right. and it's full fat, whole milk yogurt. And it's tough to get kids away from flavored yogurts if that's what they're used to. And these flavored yogurts are really a problem, because if you look at the label per volume, they have just as much sugar as a soda in many cases. So they're really a problem for having a huge amount of sugar. And if you have kids that, and we talk about this in the book, strategies to get kids from that sort of sweetened yogurt into plain yogurt that is that doesn't have that sweetness. We actually, with our daughters, would give them plain yogurt and mix in a little bit of maple syrup or honey, and then gradually over the course of weeks, just weaned them off of that. And pretty soon they're eating the plain yogurt. You know, it's just changing their palate a little bit and getting them used to these foods. And that's another thing that's really tough for parents. I think parents don't want to, you know, you come home at the end of a long day and you don't want to fight the battle with your kids. You're eating your vegetables or you're not getting up. And we just really took many different approaches in trying to get our kids to eat foods that, you know, we saw other kids turn down at the table. We educated them about their gut microbes as if they have a pet living inside of them that they need to take care of and feed. We talked to them just about, you know, that in some ways it's an indoctrination. You know, we're, this is what we do as a family. We eat healthy to make sure that our gut microbes are healthy, to make sure our body's healthy. It's not always the most delicious thing on our tongue as we eat it. Certainly you drink soda and you get that bliss right away. And you may not get that with every bite of broccoli that you get, but this is something that we do just like we buckle up in the car or go to bed early to make sure we get enough sleep. It's just part of what we do to make sure we're taking care of ourselves.
And you haven't eliminated meat from your diet.
Yeah, we haven't. Yeah. So we, you know, many nights we sit down and we just kind of notice by chance that we're eating vegan. Other nights we sit down and we, you know, we have meat there. We probably eat red meat once a week or something like that. We eat vegetarian many nights. And, you know, it's just kind of a moderation thing. There's actually some really good data in the gut microbiota field showing that if you eat a lot of red meat, it's likely that your microbiota produces a compound that can produce lead to major cardiovascular events. So it's, you know, it's okay to eat red in the from the perspective of the microbiota, it appears that it's okay to eat red meat infrequently, and that your microbiota is less likely to make this harmful compound if you are not on a steady diet of red meat.
And what was life like for you, eating-wise and lifestyle-wise, before microbiota and after?
Yeah, so
it
was interesting. So actually, we had our first daughter while we were doing our postdocs at Washington University. And so we were just kind of right at the beginning of microbiota study in our training. And we're convinced that we're eating healthy. I grew up in California and like to eat organic and you know, really like vegetables. And I was convinced that we were eating this really healthy diet. And our first daughter, when she was transitioned to solid foods, became incredibly constipated. And we thought, well, this shouldn't be a problem that our family is having of any family. And so we started really examining what our daughter was eating. And we actually kept a log and totaled up the dietary fiber that we were eating per day, not really necessarily thinking about feeding the microbiota, but just from the perspective of knowing that dietary fiber was tied to motility. And what we found was that we were eating the average American diet, eating about 15 grams of dietary fiber per day, even though we thought we were eating healthy. And so we just totally revamped our diet.
What did you eliminate? What was...
Yeah, so, you know, we ate a lot of pasta. We had, you know, quesadillas, cheese and flour tortillas. And we'd maybe throw in some cucumbers or tomatoes in there. But if you total up the dietary fiber, this is just not a great way to eat. And so we really started thinking about, you know, I think it's really hard to change eating habits for people. And so what we started thinking about is, can we take the food that we normally eat, the recipes that we normally cook, and just fiberify them? So when you make risotto, instead of using some starchy, you know, pasta, can you use a whole grain as the basis of it? Can you, you know, substitute in nuts into, you know, what you're cooking instead of meat as a way to incorporate more fiber, but get, you know, some protein and fat in there as well? And so we talk about that in the book as well, and we have some recipes, just ways to take kind of classically what people cook in the United States and just put a fiber spin on it and think about ways of just incorporating more fiber into the diet. This ended up solving my daughter's motility problem in really, you know, rapid fashion. And, you know, we've been constipation free since that time, and also become more aware that fiber is just this really important component of feeding the gut microbiota.
You open one chapter by stating in writing, your genome is not your destiny. Now, the exploration of the genome has sort of convinced people that it is destiny.
Right.
What story are you trying to tell with that sentence?
Yeah, well, I think what's become apparent is that we have these two really important facets of our biology. We have our human genome, which we're born with and is very difficult to change. And then we have these microbes that we carry around that are incredibly malleable. You can change this community over time based on what you eat, based on avoiding antibiotics if you can, based on your lifestyle. And so considering that, this one major component of our biology is malleable, can be changed, that we really hold the reins to determining what microbes we harbor and what they're doing in our digestive tract, that really gives us a huge amount of power to dictate a lot of our health. And so certainly there are things in your human DNA that you can't escape that are your destiny, but there's the vast majority of diseases that are afflicting Westerners are diseases that have inflammation as a basis. So I mentioned these before: heart disease, cancer, diabetes, autoimmune diseases. All of these diseases that are driven by inflammation are modifiable by the gut microbiota because the gut microbiota directly connects to inflammation. And so that means that by eating a healthy diet and trying to create the best possible microbiota that you can actually influence how likely you are to get those diseases, maybe even how severe those diseases are if you already have them.
What's the causal relationship between cesarean deliveries? What impact did they have?
Yeah, so there's if you go to the epidemiological data, there is data tying cesarean sections to increased chance of things like asthma. The work on the gut microbiota really hasn't followed a cohort of kids that have been born by C-section to look at how their gut microbiota develops over the course of many, many years. Those studies are actually happening right now, and they'll be reported probably sometime in the next couple of years. What is apparent is that moments after birth, if you're born by C-section, your gut microbiota looks totally different than a child that's born through the birth canal. So a child that's born through the birth canal, their gut microbiota over the first few days looks like their mother's gut microbiota, vaginal microbiota. If you look at a baby born by C-section, the microbes that reside in the gut are, over the first week or so, are microbes that are from the skin, and not even the mother's skin, from other people's skin, because this baby's being handled. And so when you're born, you actually don't have a gut microbiota, and whatever microbes you get exposed to first are the microbes that...
As you begin life, as you make the way through the birthing process.
Exactly. So if you go through the birth canal, the first microbes you're exposed to from your mother's vagina are the ones that will colonize your digestive tract. And that's, of course, what evolution has, what we're adapted for. And in cases of C-section, you're actually exposing your child to skin microbes. Now, there's probably, plenty of people have been born by C-section and live really healthy lives. So, I don't think this is disastrous in any way. Both of my daughters actually were born by C-section. We took extreme care to make sure that they were breastfed. It's known that breastfeeding compounds in breast milk are really important in feeding and helping assemble the gut microbiota. And then making sure also to get back to this hand washing issue that, over the course of our child's, first year or two of life, that we weren't crazy about sanitizing their hands, our hands. But it's a cost benefit analysis. We don't say that you should never wash your hands. Of course, if you go to a grocery store or a Subway or a place like that where there could be a lot of viruses, harmful things, you probably do want to wash your hands. If you've been out gardening in your yard or petting your dog and you know that there aren't any chemicals around, you may not have to be so crazy about hand washing because that shouldn't be an area where there are a lot of pathogenic organisms.
With all of the marketing ploys out there today about foods and health and the best way to proceed and how to keep healthy and how to live to 90 and how to live to 100, what's your best advice for someone who's trying to navigate the world of eating?
Yeah, and this, so I think that there's one rule to follow, and I think everything else falls into place after that. I think it's incredibly simple, And I think people are overthinking this, overstudying it. And the reason is that we're coming from the standpoint of processed foods, where we're building foods from the ground up. You know, you put in this, you put in that, you have different components that you're putting in. You're saying, well, do we need more vitamin D? Do we need more of this? Do we need more of that? And really, I think if you just step back a moment and think, well, the diseases that are most likely to kill me are diseases that these cultures that just eat real food don't get. You know, they don't suffer from inflammatory bowel disease. They don't get autoimmune diseases, really. And certainly heart disease and cancers are much more prevalent in the Western world. And so I think that my wife and I we joke about what our second book is going to be, and I don't know if we'll ever write one, but we were thinking the one rule diet, because it's so disorienting, all these different rules that people are trying to follow. The one rule is eat a lot of dietary fiber that's based around plants. And if you do this, you can be full. You can eat almost as much as you want, and you're not eating a lot of calories. You're getting all kinds of natural plant compounds that are healthy for you, and you're feeding your gut microbiota. And if you do that first, if you eat tons of dietary fiber, that's all that matters, because you're not going to crave eating a bunch of soda or eating a bunch of fatty fried food because you're full.
And then you can have a brownie too.
And that's the thing. Moderation is important. We certainly, you know, we eat dessert with most meals. Sometimes it's just a square of dark chocolate, but other times it's ice cream and, you know, certainly a brownie or something like that once in a while. If I go to a ball game, I'll have a hot dog there. You know, I think moderation is really important. But I think if you generally follow this simple rule of just eating a lot of plants first before you eat other things, everything else falls into place.
You know, I knew your book was successful when I saw it at Costco.
Oh, great.
You know, when you see a book at Costco, you know it's success.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
Justin Sonnenberg, the author, along with his wife, Erica, of The Good Gut, thank you for joining me in One-to-One.
Thanks a lot, Paul.
The preceding program is copyrighted by the Board of Trustees of Stanford University. One-to-One is produced by the School of Medicine's Office of Communication and Public Affairs. For more information, please visit us at mednews.stanford.edu.